It's your Radio Theater Channel weekly podcast for download. The RTC for 20 great years has the best OTR on our live streaming. And continue tuning in to the Radio Book Channel, along with the RTC Music Channel, all at oldtimeradiolisten.com.
Hello, all you radio lovers. We're back with 90 minutes of great old-time radio, and it's a mixed bag this time. We're going to feature Dragnet to start out with, an episode of Escape and Gunsmoke out there in the Old West. But we'll start off with Dragnet. From 1952, this is the Big Almost No Show.
The story you are about to hear is true. The names have been changed to protect the innocent.
Fatima Cigarettes, best of all king-size cigarettes, brings you Dragnet on both radio and television.
You're a detective sergeant. You're assigned a homicide detail. A woman reports the disappearance of her 30-year-old brother. He's been missing for only 2 days, but the manner of his disappearance was sudden, out of the ordinary. Your job? Investigate. Fatima, America's first, largest-selling blended cigarette. Fatima, now best of all king-size cigarettes.
Prove it yourself, today. Compare Fatima with the king-size cigarette you are now smoking.
One, Fatima's length filters the smoke 85 millimeters for your protection.
Two, Fatima's length cools the smoke for your protection.
Three, Fatima's length gives you those extra puffs, 21% longer than standard cigarette size.
And in Fatima, you get an extra mild and soothing smoke, plus the added protection of Fatima quality.
Definitely the best quality in its class, but the same price as the cigarette you're now smoking.
Buy Fatima in the bright, sunny yellow pack. Best of all, king-size cigarettes.
Dragnet, the documented drama of an actual crime. For the next 30 minutes, in cooperation with the Los Angeles Police Department, you will travel step by step on the side of the law through an actual case transcribed from official police files. From beginning to end, from crime to punishment, Dragnet is the story of your police force in action.
It was Wednesday, November 14th. It was overcast in Los Angeles. We were working the day watch out of homicide detail. My partner's Ed Jacobs. The boss is Captain Lorman. My name's Friday. We were on the way out from the office, and it was 8:56 a.m. when we got to the S&H Paper Company on 4th Street, the rear entrance.
Where do we find her, Joe? Upstairs?
No, main floor. She told me we'd find her in the timekeeper's office. She said it was near the back door entrance. We couldn't miss it.
Let's give a look down the corridor, huh? Maybe one of the workers can tell us.
Yeah, right. Looks like some kind of an office there, doesn't it? Just beyond the time clock?
Yeah. Let's see. Paymaster head timekeeper. Yeah, that's it.
The door's locked, Ed. You want to rap on the pay window?
Yeah.
Yes?
Police officers, ma'am. We have an appointment with Miss Edith Tabor.
Oh, yes, officers. I'm Edith Tabor. Just a moment, please. I'll ring the buzzer. Just push on the door.
All right, thank you, ma'am. Go ahead, Ed.
All right.
Are you the one I talked to on the phone, Sergeant Friday?
Yes, ma'am, that's right. This is my partner, Sergeant Jacobs.
How do you do?
This is about your brother, Miss Tabor. Ralph Tabor, is that right?
Yes, that's right. I know there must be something wrong. Ralph's been gone since Sunday. No one's seen him, no one's heard from him. I'm worried sick about it.
Last time you saw him was on Sunday?
No, I didn't actually see him. I talked to him on the phone. We made a date for dinner. Ralph and I always have dinner together Sunday nights. It's about the only time in the week we do get to see each other.
I see. I believe you told me on the phone you already checked with most of his friends the places he'd most likely be, is that right?
I've called everyone I can think of. No one's seen him.
Your brother's never done anything like this before, miss? Going off without telling anyone?
No, never. I'm very worried, Sergeant.
Can you think of any reason at all why he'd want to disappear of his own free will, I mean?
No. No reason in the world for it. He seemed perfectly all right when I talked to him on the phone Sunday. Everything was fine. We made a date for the movies Tuesday night. That was for last night. Picture downtown we wanted to see. He made a special point of it. I just know something must have happened.
Mm-hmm. I gather you know most of your brother's friends. You've kept in fairly close touch with him, haven't you?
Yes, we get together at least once a week, as I say. I'm 4 years older than Ralph. I've looked after him since we were kids. We've always been together, the last 5 or 6 years especially, ever since Mama died.
Your brother in a pretty stable mental condition, was he? No financial worries, nothing of that kind?
No, sir, nothing I know about.
I'd like to double-check this information that you gave me on the phone, Miss Tabor. Mm-hmm. Her name and address and his description,
yes,
all right?
Yes, sir. Mm-hmm.
The full name, Ralph Lawrence Tabor, 14316 Al Maiden Street, male, white American, occupation, interior decorator, is that it?
Yes, that's right.
Height, 5'11", 155 pounds, dark blonde hair, gray eyes, fair complexion, birthmark on left side of neck.
Yes, that's all correct.
Your brother in the habit of carrying large sums of money around with him, do you know?
No, not that I know of. He has a good job. He's not getting rich at it, though. I don't think I've ever seen Ralph with more than $20, $30 on him at a time.
Mm-hmm. Who was the last person to see him, miss? You any idea?
Well, I talked to Ralph's landlady. She told me she saw Ralph and this friend of his, Andy Howard, going into Ralph's apartment. That was about 6 o'clock Sunday night. Ralph was supposed to meet me at 7:30, never showed up.
Now, this friend of your brother's, Miss Tabor, this Andy Howard, are you acquainted with him?
Yes, but I don't know him too well. I only met him 2 or 3 times. He lives in the apartment house next door to Ralph's, so the two of them were friends in the Navy together during the war. Good friends.
You tried to get in touch with this Andy Howard?
Yes. I called Ralph's apartment when he didn't show up for our dinner date Sunday night. Wasn't any answer, so I looked up Andy's number in the phone book and called him.
Mm-hmm. Was he at home?
Yes. Tried to talk to him, but it didn't do much good. Strange.
How's that?
He pretended he didn't even know me.
After we finished our interview with Edith Tabor, Ed Jacobs and I started out to double-check with all the known friends and associates of her brother. We talked to his employer and the people he worked with. None of them had seen him subsequent to 6 o'clock Sunday night. None of them could think of any good reason why he suddenly would want to pick up and leave his job and friends. The people he knew outside of his work told us the same thing. Nobody could explain it. Along the way, we inquired about Ralph Tabor's friend, Andy Howard. Most of the people we talked to knew him as a close friend of Tabor's. We checked at Howard's place of employment, but they told us he hadn't shown up for work since the previous Friday. We drove to Howard's apartment, checked with the manager, and he said that Howard had moved without notice late Sunday night. We crossed over to the apartment house next door, where Tabor lived, and talked to the landlady, a Mrs. Higby. She corroborated the story we'd gotten from Tabor's sister that Andy Howard was last seen entering Tabor's apartment at about 6 o'clock Sunday night. Tabor was with him. Mrs. Higby was sure of that. She showed us up to the third floor to Ralph Tabor's apartment. The two rooms and the adjoining kitchenette were immaculate. There wasn't a thing out of place.
Neat as a pin, Joe. Not a thing out of order.
Yeah, it's the same in the bedroom. Say, Mrs. Higby.
Yes, Sergeant.
Do you provide maid service with the apartments here?
No, we don't. We've been thinking about it, though. Haven't quite made up our minds. Such a task, getting good, competent help these days.
And the tenants are responsible for the entire upkeep, huh?
Yes. Everything but painting, wallpapering, things like that. Doesn't Mr. Tabor keep things spotless? Just spotless?
Yes, ma'am. There's just one thing I wanted to ask you about. It's over here by the window.
Yes.
Now, this wire here... Apparently an aerial connection for a television set, looks like
me. Yes. Mr. Tabor does have a television. Why?
Well, I don't notice a set anywhere in the apartment. Would you happen to recall if he sent it out for repairs, anything like that?
No, not that I know of. Besides, this doesn't seem like Mr. Tabor at all.
How do you mean, Miss Higby?
Well, he's always so neat, fastidious. The end of that wire there looks like it was torn off the connection, doesn't it? Along the windowsill, too, isn't that terrible? Fasteners for the wire ripped right out of the woodwork. That certainly doesn't seem like Mr. Tabor.
Mm-hmm. Anyone else besides him have access to this apartment, ma'am?
No one that I know of. No one besides myself, I mean. I have duplicate keys to all the apartments. Well, I just happened to think.
Yes, ma'am?
If a repairman did move the set out, it's possible my houseboy might know about it. Sam, that's my houseboy.
How would he know about it?
Well, it's a rule of the house. All furniture, heavy things like that, they have to be taken down in the freight elevator. It opens right onto the alley in back of the building. It's very handy.
Yes, ma'am.
Sam's the only one who operates that elevator. That's why I say it's possible he might know about it. Would you like to have me ask him?
I wonder if you would, please.
Surely. It won't take but a minute, and I'll be right back.
Thank you, Miss Higgins.
Joe, you want to have a look over here?
Yeah. What do you got?
This wall bed here. I tried to pull it down. It's stuck.
Mm-hmm.
Stand right here. Oh, over here. See if you notice anything.
Yeah, I do. You want to give me a hand? See if we can't get the bed down?
Yeah.
Push in on your side.
Okay.
That's it. Okay. It's coming down now.
Good Lord.
Yeah.
Tabor, you think?
Well, the description seems to fit. Beaten to death, looks like, doesn't it?
Something sticking out under the bed covers there.
Yeah, it's a claw hammer. Stains all over it.
Vicious. Guess a killer one to make sure.
It's one of the worst I've seen.
Feel sorry for the sister. She was pretty close to him. It's going to be tough on her.
No tougher than it was for him. 2:38 p.m. We phoned the office, told them what we'd found, and then we put in a call for Lieutenant Lee Jones and the crime lab crew. While we were waiting, we questioned the landlady again, Mrs. Higby. She said her houseman, Sam, told her he knew nothing about a television set being moved out of Ralph Tabor's apartment. However, it was possible somebody could have taken the set down in the main elevator late at night without being seen. Mrs. Higby also told us that Tabor had a car. We checked the apartment garage, but it was gone. All Mrs. Higby could tell us was that it was a late model car and that Tabor often loaned it to his friend Andy Howard. Sergeants Al Shambra and Joe LaMonica from Homicide arrived, and together the four of us interviewed the employees and the tenants in the apartment building. They gave us little or nothing at all. A few minutes before 3 p.m., the crime lab crew showed up and started their preliminary investigation. We put in a call for the coroner. From the obvious lack of fingerprints in usual places around the apartment, it was apparent that the murderer had taken great precautions to cover his tracks. 3:35 p.m., the deputy coroner arrived, and after the preliminary investigation was finished, the body was removed to the county morgue. Ed and I went back to the office, checked our DMV, and got out on all points on Tabor's car and also on the friend he was last seen with, Andy Howard. R&I turned up a single entry for Howard's criminal record, a drunk driving charge. 5:20 p.m., we met with Edith Tabor and broke the news of her brother's death. When she recovered from the shock, we interviewed her briefly.
It was Andy Howard. I know it was him. It had to be.
Why do you say that, Miss Tabor? There's something about this man Howard you haven't told us?
He's no good, Sergeant. He's no good at all. That's what I've been afraid of. I've been afraid of it right along.
Well, just how do you mean, ma'am, he's no good?
He's a tramp, a bum. Won't get a job. He's been living off my brother. He isn't normal. There's something wrong with him.
Well, how is it your brother put up with him?
Well, I told you, he and Ralph were friends in the Navy. He did a big favor for Ralph once. He's been living off it ever since. Taking his clothes, borrowing his car, money, never paying it back.
Why do you think he killed your brother, miss?
I just know it. That's all. He did it.
He ever fight with your brother? Would you happen to know? Did he ever threaten him?
They had a big fight one night, about 2 weeks ago, I think. Andy kept sponging until Ralph got good and sick of it. Told Andy to go out and get a job. That's when the fight started.
You saw it, did you?
Ralph told me about it. Fist fight in the alley back of the apartment. Ralph knocked Andy down. Andy said he'd never forget it. He'd pay Ralph back. A couple of days after that, my brother said the two of them made up. Everything was all right. Ralph should have known better. He should have known better.
Mm-hmm. Just a few more questions, Miss Tabor. Can you tell us anything about Andy Howard's background, where he's from, who his friends are, places he usually goes?
No. I didn't know much about him. He's from the South, I think, Alabama. Ralph's friends can tell you more about him than I can.
All right. Had you heard anything lately about Howard planning to move out of his apartment?
No, nothing. When I heard that he did move and Ralph was missing, I knew something was wrong. That's why I called you. If I'd only known before. Poor Ralph, if I only knew.
I'll try to take it easy, ma'am. We'll arrange for a car to drive you home, all right?
It's so hard to understand. It's hard. For anyone to kill Ralph like that, horrible. He was so good. He was my brother.
Yes, ma'am.
What do you say to a man who kills your brother? How do you understand him? What do you tell him?
Well, why even try?
What?
Let the jury tell him. Before we had the victim's sister, Edith Tabor, driven to her home, we asked her about the television set in her brother's apartment, but she was unable to explain its absence. Burglary detail had already been notified about the case, and the pawn shop detail alerted. An APB had been gotten out containing a complete description of the TV set along with the serial numbers. A few minutes after we got back from dinner that night, we had an answer on it. A pawn shop operator on West 7th Street called in with the information that he'd taken in a television set with identical description and serial numbers as that of Tabor's. Ed and I drove out to the pawn shop and checked the operator's buy book. The set had been pawned the day after the murder. The serial numbers and description matched in every detail. The description and signature of the man who pawned it matched perfectly with that of Ralph Tabor's friend, Andy Howard. The set was impounded, and just on a chance, we had Dean Bergman dusted for latent fingerprints.
Dean?
Oh, hi, Ed. Friday.
How you making out? Any luck?
Not bad. Have a look here.
Yeah.
Picked up four sets of prints off it, all told. These here are the dead man's.
Yeah.
These here, they belong to the pawn shop operator.
Mm-hmm.
He's born to his son, helps him in the shop.
Yeah.
Guess this is the one you're looking for. Two clean index prints.
Did you classify them?
Checked them against prints from Andrew Howard's package.
Yeah.
They match.
When we checked in for work the following morning, we got the coroner's report on Ralph Tabor. The cause of death was listed as cerebral hemorrhage and multiple fractures of the skull caused by blows from a heavy blunt object. The other reports from the crime lab didn't give us much help. The better part of the next 3 days, Ed and I, along with Al Shambra and Joe LaMonica, held detailed interviews with the known friends and associates of the murder victim, Ralph Tabor, and the number one suspect, Andy Howard. The information we picked up was incorporated in a supplementary all-points bulletin and gotten out immediately. We found out that Andy Howard had a sailor's uniform in his possession, and though unauthorized, he wore it frequently. It bore the insignia of a quartermaster first class on the sleeve. We also found out Howard had identical tattoos on each forearm, the picture of an unfurled American flag with the name Betty D below it. We had the city covered for the suspect. 4 days passed, no trace of him. Saturday, November 24th, we got an urgent call from Homicide Commander Lieutenant Mort Geer in San Diego.
On the highway?
Uh-huh.
When was that, Mort? I see. Right. Hey, Joe, you got a pencil, eh?
Yep, here you go.
Thanks. Hey, Mort, he's pretty sure, huh? Uh-huh. Well, yeah, he seems to tie in all right. How's that? Well, I don't know for sure. We'll check with Captain Lorman right now and let you know. Yeah, thanks, Mark. Goodbye. Good break.
What do you have to say?
One of their traffic men down there, a fellow by the name of Jack Ladd, stopped a car on the highway going out of town speeding.
Yeah.
Ladd says a man answers Andy Howard's description perfectly, uh-huh. Right down to the tattoo on the forearm. No doubt about the car the guy was driving was Tabor's description and license number. He even used Tabor's identification.
Well, when did all this happen?
Day after the murder. They'd have held the man, but they didn't have the information at the time.
That's a bum break. Which way was Howard going, they tell you?
Yeah, into town. They figure he's still there someplace.
How do you mean?
Found the car an hour ago, abandoned.
10 minutes after the phone call from San Diego, Captain Lorman checked back in at the office, and Ed and I met with him. We told him about the information San Diego had phoned in, and he gave Ed and I an immediate okay for the trip south. We went down to the garage, picked up a car, and 6 hours later, we checked in with Sergeant Russ Ormsby, San Diego Homicide.
What's this, another fishing trip, or are we doing business this time?
Great, it's all business, Russ. The Andy Howard thing. More gear around?
No, I won't be back till later. I can brief you on it, though. McGuire and I have been working it on this end.
Well, how about Tabor's car? You still got it staked out?
Yeah, no nibbles yet. What do you figure? If nothing happens, pull it in tomorrow, process it for prints?
Yeah.
We've had something warmer than that since Mort Geer called you. It looks pretty good.
Yeah, what do you got?
Well, I came up with it a couple of hours ago. Field interrogation card made out last night west end of town.
Mm-hmm.
Beat officer by the name of Driscoll questioned a man and a girl parked in a car out that way last night. There's a description on the man.
Thanks, Russ.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
Fitz Howard all the way in here.
Mm-hmm. Couldn't get much closer.
We checked out the car they were in. Belongs to the girl.
Yeah. Look here, Ed. He's still using Tabor's identification.
Yeah.
All right, where's it go from here, Russ? You got this Andy Howard spotted?
No. Beatman Driscoll, he didn't know the guy from Adam.
Yeah, well, where's that leave us?
The girl Howard was with. Driscoll knew her.
We contacted the beat officer, Driscoll. The girl who'd been spotted sitting in a parked car the night before with murder suspect Andy Howard was identified as Helen McClung, a waitress in a downtown cocktail bar. A stakeout was placed in her apartment, and she was brought in for interrogation.
Well, he's not a good friend of mine. I don't know where he lives. Don't know what he does. I hardly even know him, Sergeant.
You were out for a drive with him night before, is that right?
Sure, I don't deny that. We went out for a ride. That's all there is to it.
You sure you don't know where this man lives, Helen?
Not exactly, no. He's staying at a hotel downtown, I think. We went for a ride, and I dropped him off at the bus line. That's all there was to it.
Do you expect to see him again? You have any dates with him in the next couple of days?
No. Tell you the truth, I thought I had a date. Didn't work out. Nothing ever works out. Phone this morning, called it off.
Tell you why?
He gave some lame excuse. I found out the real reason, though.
What's that? Do you mind telling us?
No, I don't mind. Got a date with my girlfriend instead, Claire Peterson. Burned me up a little, but I don't mind.
Well, where's your girlfriend live, Helen?
You mean Claire? Out on Rose Avenue, 1500 block. I'm not sure, though.
Is he going to pick her up there?
I guess so. Why?
When's the date for it, you know?
Yeah, tomorrow night.
You are listening to Dragnet, authentic stories of your police force in action.
Compare Fatima with your present king-size cigarette.
Yes, compare Fatima with the king-size cigarette you are now smoking.
One, Fatima's length filters the smoke 85 millimeters for your protection.
Two, Fatima's length cools the smoke for your protection.
Three, Fatima's length gives you those extra puffs, 21% longer than standard cigarette size.
And in Fatima, you get an extra mild and soothing smoke, plus the added protection of Fatima quality.
Friends, to show our confidence in Fatima, to convince you quickly, dramatically, that Fatima is the best of all king-size cigarettes, we make this money-back guarantee.
Buy a pack of Fatimas. Enjoy Fatima quality, extra mildness, and superbly blended tobaccos.
If you're not convinced Fatima is better than the king-size cigarette you're now smoking, just return the pack and the unsmoked Fatimas before April 1st, and we'll give you your money back plus postage. Fatima, Box 37, New York 1.
Remember, each king-size Fatima gives you an extra mild and soothing smoke, plus the added protection of Fatima quality.
Switch to Fatima today. Best of all, king-size cigarettes.
Monday, November 26th, 10 a.m. After checking her name through San Diego R&I, we finally located the address of the girl, Claire Peterson, who was supposed to have a date with our murder suspect, Andy Howard, that night. She lived in a small apartment house in the southeast end of town. The manager told us that she'd already left for work. We ran it down. The Peterson girl was employed as a cutter in a shirt factory down in the industrial district. We questioned her at her work. A tall, attractive girl, blonde, blue eyes, a small scar on her chin. She kept working while we talked to her.
Yeah, I have a date with Ralph Tabor tonight. Something the matter?
Afraid so, Miss Peterson. The first place, his name isn't Ralph Tabor.
No, I'm sorry. You must be wrong, officer. I was out with him just last Monday. I know that's his name, son. Everything he has, his car, his wallet, all his business papers. Guess you must have made a mistake.
No, it's no mistake, man. We checked it out pretty thoroughly. We'd like to talk to you about him if we could, please.
Well, there's not too much to tell. I just met him Monday night. He was with my girlfriend, Helen. He wanted to go out with me, so I made a date. I didn't think there was anything wrong.
You said he's to meet you at your apartment, Miss Peterson. Did he give any specific time when he'd be there?
8 or 8:30, he said. Hey, what's wrong, do you know? There's something wrong with a man I ought to know, don't you think?
We want him for questioning, ma'am. You any idea where he lives?
No, I haven't. One of the hotels downtown, I think. 5th Street or 6th Street. I wouldn't know for sure. Why do you want him? Can't you tell me, please?
We believe he's committed a murder, Miss Peterson. Matter of fact, we're sure of it.
What do you want me to do?
If he calls up before your date tonight, don't do anything to discourage him. Tell him to meet you. If he wants to postpone the date, try and make him come tonight. If you can't do that, try and find out where he's staying. Don't let him know we talked to you.
Well, all right, I can try. You'll be there when he comes to my apartment, I mean.
Yes, ma'am, we'll be there. You'll be protected all the way.
Well, what do you do?
Ma'am?
What do you do? You say he's a murderer. He must be desperate. What do you do? How do you arrest him?
It's his choice, ma'am. Any way he wants it.
As soon as we left the plant where the Peterson girl worked, we called Sergeant Tony McGuire at San Diego Homicide Detail, and he made arrangements for an immediate stakeout at the girl's apartment. At 7 p.m., Ed and I, along with Russ Ormsby and Tony McGuire, drove out to supplement the men on stakeout at the girl's apartment. 8 o'clock, 9, 9:30, 10 p.m., still no sign of the suspect. At midnight, our relief team showed up, and we headed back for the office. When we got there, there was a bulletin from the highway patrol reporting that earlier that night, a man partially identified as Andy Howard had been seen heading north from San Diego on U.S. Highway 101 toward Los Angeles. We got Captain Lorman on the phone, briefed him on the latest developments, and told him that photographs of the suspect had been distributed to all officers. The next 10 hours failed to turn up anything new. San Diego officers continued to cover their end. 11:15 p.m. the next day. We drove back to Los Angeles and reported in at homicide. There was a note in the book from Lorman asking us to check in early the following morning, so Ed and I signed out and went home to get some sleep. The next morning, 1:45 a.m. Hello, Friday talking.
Sorry to wake you up, Friday. This is Hawkins down the business office.
Oh, yeah, Hawkins. What do you got?
Beat officer out in Wilshire called in 2 or 3 minutes ago. He figures he has your murder suspect for you, Andy Howard. Bring him in now.
Well, what about identification? He checked that over?
No identification. He's wearing a sailor's uniform.
What about insignia, his rating?
Quartermaster First Class.
After I hung up, I phoned Ed, got him out of bed, and the two of us drove down to the office where we picked up the suspect and took him to the interrogation room. During the interrogation, we found a wallet concealed on his person. It contained a driver's license, credit card, and half a dozen other means of identification. All of them were made out to Ralph Tabor. After an hour of questioning, he'd still admit nothing. He sat hunched over in his chair, tearing an old envelope into small pieces and dropping them on the floor in front of him.
This will make the 10th time I told you. I don't know what happened to Ralph. I didn't take his car or his television set. I didn't leave the city. I wasn't in San Diego last week. Now, if you don't believe me, you prove I'm lying.
We didn't pull you in on the guess, Andy. We'll prove it.
You mind telling me how?
We got three people on their way in here right now. Ralph Tabor's sister, his landlady, a man by the name of Sims, pawn shop dealer. Mean anything to you?
It's my word against theirs.
3-1, mister. I got the odds in their favor.
Look, why don't we straighten this out once and for all? You think I killed my friend Ralph. Why? Explain it to me. Why should I kill him?
Look, I wouldn't know, Andy. Maybe you'd like to tell us. His sister says he was pretty good to you.
She was good to me. I guess she didn't tell you what I did for him overseas when we were in the Navy together.
No, she didn't tell us.
She wouldn't. Stupid women. I haven't found one of them worth anything. Frustrated. She needs a husband. That's her trouble.
She claims her brother was paying the bills for you, Andy. He gave you clothes, money, his car. She says you were living off of him.
Lousy woman, that's all the thanks I get for all I did for Ralph. I borrowed a few dollars, yeah, that's all. Kept throwing it up to me, him and his sister, after all I did for him.
What are you trying to say, Andy?
Could have been different, Ralph and me. What do you want me to say?
Did you kill him? Did you kill him, Andy?
You can't explain it that way. It's not as simple as that.
Didn't?
No, it's all mixed up together. It's complicated. It's not simple at all. I mean, with your best friend especially. It's more of a mistake. I mean, morally, I didn't mean to kill him. I just did. It's a mistake. Terrible mistake.
You want to give us a statement, Howard? Stenographer will take it down.
Oh, yeah, all right, in a minute. Just want to make sure you understand. I mean about Ralph. And all I did for him.
Yeah.
No gratitude at all. You blame me? I mean, after all I did for him, you blame me?
Well, you should have remembered, Andy, about gratitude.
Yeah?
Doesn't mean much when you have to ask for it.
The story you have just heard was true. The names were changed to protect the innocent. On February 4th, trial was held in Superior Court, Department 89, City and County of Los Angeles, State of California. In a moment, the results of that trial. And now, here is our star, Jack Webb.
Thank you, George Fenneman. Friends, you've been listening to Dragnet for the past 28 minutes. Now, it'll take you less than 28 seconds to prove that Fatima is the best of all king-size cigarettes. Just compare Fatima with the king-size cigarette you're now smoking. Fatima filters the smoke through a long distance of 85 millimeters. Fatima's length cools the smoke for your protection. Fatima's length gives you those extra puffs, 21% longer than standard cigarette size. And in Fatima, you get an extra mild and soothing smoke, plus the added protection of Fatima quality. Prove it today. Buy Fatima.
Andrew Thomas Howard was tried and convicted of murder in the second degree. He is now serving his term in the state penitentiary, San Quentin, California. Second degree murder is punishable by imprisonment from 5 years to life. Ladies and gentlemen, right now, inflation is America's number one menace on the home front. It's the one enemy that can lick America. We can help prevent this by working harder, working better. The fight against inflation will succeed only if all of us get behind it. You have just heard Dragnet, a series of authentic cases from official files. Technical advice comes from the Office of Chief of Police W.H. Parker, Los Angeles Police Department. Heard tonight were Barney Phillips, Joyce McCluskey, and Virginia Gregg. Script by Jim Moser. Music by Walter Schumann. Hal Gibney speaking. Fatima Cigarettes. Best of all, King Size Cigarettes has brought you Dragnet, transcribed from Los Angeles. Next, it's David Harding and Counterspy on NBC.
Now, our next show is Escape, and it's The Time Machine. And if you had a time machine, you could go back and buy some of those delicious Fatimas if you're a smoker. but we don't have a time machine, except in fiction. And right now, we're going to hear all about it. From 1948, this is Escape, The Time Machine.
Escape! You were rushing forward through time, far into the future, trying desperately to flee the clutching fingers of a band of night creatures, a dreamlike horror from which there seems no escape. Escape, designed to free you from the four walls of today for a half hour of high adventure.
Tonight we escape to the year 100,080 and to a world where beauty and terror live side by side, as H.G. Wells described it in his immortal story, The Time Machine.
You must be mad, Dudley. A time machine.
Yes, my friend. A time machine.
This thing?
This very thing.
Well, this contraption, this whatever it is, made of quartz and brass and ivory, with its levers and dials and its seat in the middle. This is the result of 3 years' hard work?
I promise you, Fowler, that on this machine, a man can go wherever he likes in time. By working these levers, a man can choose his century, his year, his very day.
Oh, that's impossible. It's out of the question.
In one of the journeys I've already taken on this little contraption.
Well, I'm afraid you're having a bad dream.
You mean I've developed into a liar? Very well, you shall have proof, my friend.
Oh.
Just climb on, Fowler. Sit in a seat with me. I'll take you for a little spin.
You mean right now?
Right now.
Well, just in case it should work, aren't there any preparations we should make?
No, Fowler. You won't need any luggage on this trip, not even a toothbrush. You'll be back in less than a minute.
All right. I'm on. Now what?
Hold tight, because it sways a good deal. I'd hate to lose you.
Well, I can't be frightened, Dudley.
Then you're braver than I am. Tell me, what time is it?
It's just 12 noon.
Before we start, I want to adjust this control a bit.
Is everything ship-shaped?
Oh, yes. Tell me, did you notice anything just then?
Only a noise, a humming noise, nothing else.
And what time is it?
You just asked me, old man. It's... That's funny.
What?
My watch says 11 o'clock. I could have sworn it was noon a moment ago. Huh. Must be something wrong with it.
There's nothing wrong with the watch. It's only that I touched the lever to test it. And we've gone forward a full day. 23 hours at any rate.
Dudley.
Have you finished scoffing, Fowler?
Yes, I believe I have.
Then hold tight. This will be the real article.
I'm ready, Dudley.
Good man. Well, say goodbye, Fowler. Say goodbye to 1948.
We went off with a shattering jar. With the machine swaying under us, the walls of Dr. Dudley's laboratory suddenly fell away, and night was speeding after day like the flapping of a black wing. I saw the sun hopping across the sky, leaping swiftly across it every second and every second marking a day. I saw the moon spinning through her quarters like a ball, from new to full, all in the twinkling of an eye. Trees grew and blossomed like puffs of smoke and then passed away, and all the while we were going faster, and now our pace was a year a second. So that second by second, the white snow flashed across the world and was followed by the bright, brief spring. And still we went on into the future.
How do you feel, Fowler?
Sort of weak and very dizzy.
Don't let go. Don't fall off.
Where are we? How far have we come?
We're in 100,000 and 50 and 60 and 70.
That's enough. Stop it, Dudley. I can't stand anymore. Stop it.
Fowler, are you all right?
Yeah, I believe so. No broken bones. What happened?
I'm not sure. I must have stopped too suddenly.
Where are we, Dudley?
Look around for yourself. On a wide lawn, in a beautiful, vast garden.
I meant geographically.
Just where we were when we started. We're standing exactly on the spot where my laboratory stood 100,000 years ago.
And the year?
100,080.
It seemed absolutely incredible. A dream, but a pleasant one. For the garden in which we found ourselves was beautiful and summery and inviting. At some distance, we could see a large, imposing building. All was quiet and peaceful, almost too much so. And the sense of strangeness, of incredible strangeness, sent a shiver up my spine.
100,080.
Dudley, have you thought what we might find here? What manner of man? What danger?
I don't see any men at all.
Well, perhaps they don't exist at all anymore. If they do, what are they like? How have they developed?
There's been a long interval between us, more than 100,000 years. We won't know until we see them.
And then it may be too late. Suppose the race has lost its manliness and has become a savage animal.
Do you want to go back?
Yes, Dudley, I'm frightened. Let's go back.
Dudley! From over there in the bushes.
It sounded human.
Come on.
But, Dudley, we don't have any weapons.
Come on!
Oh, it's a child. Look, it seems to be a very small girl.
There's been a beast here of some kind. It struggled with her. Look at the marks on her arms.
See here, my dear. You'll be all right now. You won't be harmed. Oh, of course, she wouldn't understand English.
I don't think it's that. She's motioning us to go with her. I don't believe they have any language at all, Dudley.
What about the animal? Did you see it?
No, not a glimpse. It was too fast for us.
Perhaps we'd better go back, Dudley. The girl seems to be all right now.
Leave her like this. Without seeing her people and the way they live? You want to go back so soon?
Yeah, I've had enough.
Well, they haven't, old man. Because they're here. All around us.
They had crept up on soundless feet to surround us, the little people of this era. And the girl we'd saved was not a child, but a full-grown woman. For they all stood 4 feet high, dressed in simple tunics, beautiful creatures, but terribly frail, with a plump, soft kind of frailty. Their mouths were small, and their little chins ran to a point, and they made no sound. They were like eerie figures in a dream, and all we could hear was the heavy rustling of their clothes as they surged happily around us, their faces wreathed in smiles. Why, they're not savage at all. They're very loving and gentle little people.
Yes, but there's something terribly wrong with them.
How do you mean?
They seem to have the minds of 5-year-olds. This one over here has been trying to talk to me with gestures. Look at him. He seems to be asking me if I've come from the sun or a thunderstorm.
How did you expect him to be?
Far ahead of us, of course. Incredibly ahead of us in knowledge and in science. And look at them. Children.
Well, they seem happy in this huge garden of theirs. That's something. I've changed my mind, Dudley. Maybe we shall enjoy spending a few days with our little friends. The little people led us home into their valley. They lived in colossal buildings, sleeping all together in one huge hall, eating in another, playing and frolicking together in the sunshine, and Dudley and I lived with them for days in utter contentment. One afternoon, we walked together along the banks of the great river.
There's no apparent difference among the sexes. They all wear the same clothes, have the same soft, hairless skin, same feminine roundness of limbs.
Yeah. I wonder if it's because they're vegetarians.
They're vegetarians because they have to be. You haven't run across any horses or dogs or cattle of any kind, have you?
No, now that you mention it.
With good reason. They're all extinct by now. Just as the dinosaur is with us.
Dudley, there's something very strange here. Something hidden away and silent.
You may be right. Anyway, I've taken the precaution of removing the controls from the machine. I don't much fancy the idea of someone riding away with it into another century and leaving us here for the rest of our lives.
Dudley, do you recognize this bit of ground?
Why, yes, this is where we landed.
I thought so. I wasn't sure.
Why do you ask?
Can't you see? Look around. It's empty. What's happened to the machine?
They've taken it away. They've stolen it.
Where, Dudley? Where?
Look. See the tracks where they've dragged it? Over here. Come along. Right here. By this monument, the end of the trail.
Those are brass doors in the base, and they're locked.
The machine, it must be in there inside. We must get it. Break down the doors.
Well, how can we?
Here, we use the levers.
Oh, it's no good, Dudley. They're solid. We'll never break through.
Never? Never? Do you mean stay here for all our lives? Do you mean never go home again? They must open the machine, the time machine.
The time machine was gone. The brass doors of the monument held. Our retreat was cut off, the thin line by which we could make our way back home, back to our own time and our own people. But there seemed nothing we could do. We had no way of communicating with the little people, of asking what they had done with the machine and why and how to get it back. They merely stood around and watched our vain efforts. There was nothing hostile in their attitude. They were more like simple, wondering children. Only one, the young woman, Weena, whose life we had saved on our first day, had become really friendly. She went with us wherever we walked and brought us presents of garlands of flowers, slept near us at night in the hall, and we in turn had taught her a few words of English. Now, we redoubled our efforts, like men racing against a clock, so that we might speak to her and discover the secret of our immense loss.
No, not these, Dudley. No.
How could you be so sure that your people didn't steal the machine? Aren't there any thieves among them? Are they all perfect?
That's a lot, Dudley. You awaken them. Besides, she doesn't understand.
But the thief must be sleeping somewhere in this hall. Weena, they take machine.
No, Dudley. No.
Who then? Who?
We are friends.
Yes. Yes, friends.
We need, must have machine.
Yes, Dudley. Yes.
Who took machine? Are there other people? Not yours.
Others?
What about those doors, Weena? Doors. Open.
No. Oh, no.
Weena, machine in there must open.
No. No, not open.
All right, my dear. Go to sleep. Get some rest.
Yes, Dudley. Sleep.
You too, Fowler. Try, anyway.
Yeah, I've tried. It's no good.
What's to become of us, Val? Are we caught here in this century? Should we spend our lives with the little people and their secret?
Try to sleep, Dudley. We'll go back to the monument tomorrow. We'll find a way of breaking in. Dudley.
Yes?
Did you just... There it is again.
What?
Something on my face, cold and filthy to the touch. On my face and in my hair, cold as death.
Dudley! You're right, my boy. There's something in here with us.
I smell of the grave. What was it?
I don't know. But look at them. The little people are all awake. It's as though they've been stampeded.
Let's get out of here. I want some fresh air. We went quickly through the hall and outside, away from the frantic rustling of the little people and into silence. The moon was full just overhead, and it was close to dawning. There was a faint sound speeding close behind us, and we turned, our nerves ragged and our muscles tensed. But it was only Weena coming swiftly to join us.
Weena, come closer, my girl.
Dudley.
Tell us, what do your people fear? What makes them afraid?
Afraid? Darkness.
And there is something.
What do you mean? Darkness.
Dark things. Dark places. Night.
Why? Why?
I don't know.
Why should they be afraid of the night, Dudley?
Perhaps it's not the night alone. Dark places. That's our cue. Perhaps it's something underground.
By now it was light, another day. We had wandered into a lovely wooded place, about a mile from the community. Suddenly, Weena screamed.
Dudley!
We stopped short. A pair of glaring eyes was fixed upon us. As we stood there petrified, the thing, a little ape-like figure, rushed across our path and disappeared in a clearing about 30 yards away.
Foul!
What was it?
I couldn't see it too well. It seemed to be dull white, with white hair in its head and down its back.
Looked like a small ape.
That's because it was running on all fours and with its arms held very low.
Weena, what's the matter?
Morlocks. They are Morlocks.
Who are the Morlocks? What are they? Weena, tell me.
No, go away.
Let's go over there and see where it disappeared.
In the clearing, we found a round, well-like opening. I leaned over and looked down a deep shaft, and as I did so, I saw a small white creature retreating down a ladder in the well. Something like a human spider. Its large, bright eyes watching me as it went swiftly down, and then it disappeared in the shaft.
Paula, did you see it? Like an ape?
Yeah, but like a man.
So there are two species of men in this world. Hey, Fowler.
Yes?
The little people above the ground, and this obscene thing, this bleached monster below. Two races of men in this country.
That white look. It's common to animals that live in the dark, like huge rats, like worms that are cold to the touch. I know because they've touched me.
You can feel air being sucked down into the shaft.
Yes.
The earth must be tunneled enormously here under our feet. And these monsters live in the tunnels.
I think we know now who stole our time machine.
Yes, I'm sure of it.
Then?
Then we'll go down and have a look.
No, don't go.
Why not, Weena?
Morlocks, you never come back.
We've got to have our machine, my dear. You wait for us here.
No.
But we went down, our heels ringing on the small metallic bars that were meant for creatures so much smaller than we. Down we climbed, down, ever in darkness. Down, it seemed, into the center of the earth, into the core of the world. How much longer?
We won't know till we reach bottom.
We can only stop and rest.
It can't be much further.
I'm so terribly tired.
Hang on, old man. You hear that? Like machinery. We're almost there.
Well, thank heaven for that.
All right, Fowler. I'm at the bottom. Come along, just a few more steps. Give me your hand, Fowler. Good. We're here.
Yeah. In the land of the Morlocks.
Do you have a match?
Yeah. Here.
There seems to be a large vaulted cavern at the end of the passage.
What do you suppose they'll do if they catch us?
I've no idea, so we'd better take care not to get caught. Another match.
That throbbing noise.
It's probably the ventilating system pumping air down. There must be thousands upon thousands of these Morlocks living under the earth.
And we haven't seen any yet, except for our friend who came down ahead of us. Why do you suppose they wanted our time machine?
I think they wanted us, Dudley. Not the machine.
And we've come to them.
We must. It's our only chance. Fowler, if that noise does come from air pumps,
well,
why is it so stuffy here? So oppressive?
Dudley, that smell.
Blood. Light another match. Dudley, look!
Straight ahead on the white metal table.
It's set for a meal.
Yes, with a big chunk of bloody meat.
And we know that cattle are extinct.
What do they feed on, these Morlocks?
Don't you know?
I guess I do.
Another match.
All right, I... Dudley? Dudley? I haven't got any more. We've used our last match.
All right, we'll have to go back there then. We know the secret now anyway. The Morlocks living here underground are the masters of this age. And our friends up above, fatted cattle, fed by the Morlocks, clothed and supplied and housed until the day when they're cut out from the herd and brought underground as food. This is the future you're looking at. This is what we men of the 20th century shall come to.
Dudley, what is it?
I felt hands, cold hands.
Take one of these levers. Use it as a weapon. Lash out. Against the wall. Fowler, here beside me.
Dudley, what do we do?
Do! Fight them. Kill! Use your lever, man, like this.
Dudley, they're all around us.
This way, Fowler. This way. Back this way.
We went back in that evil darkness, fighting every step as we went, back to those projecting bars, kicking and clawing ourselves loose from their pallid, grasping hands and climbing up again toward daylight and freedom, away from their stench and the eagerness of their icy hands. And they didn't follow, for daylight was their enemy and their great fear. And we lived among the lush gardens of the gentle little people like prisoners, like men without reprieve, like men who are dead, though they still walk the earth. For the time machine was locked away behind great brass doors, and we knew we could never force them open. Then, one day, Weena told us of an old building, an ancient, staggering structure that had survived through many ages and was filled with many curious objects.
A museum. That's what it must be, a museum, Fowler. Perhaps from some earlier time.
Well, I'm in no mood to go looking at a museum.
But don't you see? Specimens are hermetically sealed in museums. Perhaps there are things, weapons, machinery, something we could use.
Oh, sure, if we could find some dynamite or gunpowder or something.
We could blast those doors. We could get in.
Where is this place, Weena? This old building that no one ever goes near.
I take you, Fowler. It not far.
A chance, old man. A slim chance, but a chance nonetheless.
All day we wandered through the great ruined halls. The building had been deserted and in disuse for perhaps a century. The childlike men of that time had long since ceased to care about anything but their own personal comforts. It was late afternoon and growing dark when we came upon the chemical section. We'd found nothing useful to us until then. And now came the worst disappointment of all.
And it's dust, all of it. It's been dust for centuries.
Another dead end. It's hopeless.
We were out of our heads to hope that nitrates would retain their form for 100,000 years.
We'd better go, if nothing here.
Wait just a moment. There's something in this case.
You can break it with your lever.
Stand back a little. Hallelujah, a box of matches, hermetically sealed.
Yes, perfect. Not even damp.
And what should we do with them? Burn down those brass doors?
Better keep them anyway. At least we can smoke again. And you can't tell.
Fowler.
Yeah?
On the floor. See them? Small, narrow footprints leading away into the darkness at the end of the gallery.
Dudley.
We'd better go.
Pick Queen up and carry her. We'll have to run for it.
Don't be frightened, my dear. It'll be all right.
Go on, run!
We came out of the gloom of that place into the deeper gloom of dust. Suddenly, we saw we were trapped. All around us were the Morlocks. There were the thousand surrounding us and coming closer, a long, even line of deathly white, their eyes blinking in the half-light and their tiny mouths alive with appetite.
The matches, Dudley. Light a fire. Here, the forest is dry.
Good.
We'll have an inferno here in a minute, and our little friends don't like light or heat.
The fire leaped high to the heavens, and the countryside was ablaze. The Morlocks turned in fear, blinded by the glare. Some of them burned into the middle of the raging flames, and the rest faded away like a fog. Dudley had left a narrow passageway for our retreat, and we fled down a long corridor of leaping flames and blistering heat. We fled to safety. We fled back toward the community of the little people. And as we ran, we passed the huge monument with its great bronze doors that were locked tight on our time machine. And suddenly, in the glare of the distant fires, we saw something that stopped us short.
They're open! Fowler, the doors are open!
No! No, not go in, Dudley, no!
It's a trap. They're ready for us inside.
Ready or not, we're going in!
Dudley, it's suicide.
It'll take me about 1 minute to screw the levers in again. Then I touch them and we're away.
All right. I'll try to give you your 1 minute.
Good boy.
No. No, go. Not leave me.
You, my dear, you hold tight around my neck. You're coming home with us.
All right, let's go. We're in. Look! The machine! They haven't harmed it.
I don't see them.
Yet. Come on, quickly. Give me that other lever.
The doors, Dudley, they're closed.
Get in the seat. I'll be ready in a minute.
I waited for the hum that would signal our departure, and there in the darkness, the Morlocks were finally upon us. Cold, persistent fingers swarmed over my body, tugging at me, sucking me away from the machine, but I held tight to Weena as a man holds fast to life and tried to kick them away with my feet.
Paula.
Hurry,
Paula.
Dudley! Hurry!
I can't seem to get these levers.
Quick, or we're done!
Just another turn, and it's... There, Fowler. We're away. We're gone.
Yeah, we made it.
You all right?
I'm all right.
Good. And Weena?
Weena isn't with us.
What happened?
They tore her from my hands at the last minute. They got her.
I tried to save her. I couldn't.
I know, old man. I still got a piece of her tunic here in my fist.
A little piece of her tunic, Dudley. But nothing else. And so we came home again. Back into the very minute from which we had left. Back into 12 noon, May 9th, 1948. We were in Dudley's laboratory again, motionless, sitting on the ridiculous contraption which he called a time machine. Was it all a dream? A mad and feverish dream. Did any of it happen? Could any of it happen? No, of course not. How stupid. But then, what's this? What of this jagged piece of thick green silk I hold in my hand? What does that mean?
Escape, produced and directed by Norman McDonald, tonight brought you The Time Machine by H.G. Wells, adapted for radio by Irving Ravitch, with Eric Rolfe as Fowler, Jeff Corey as Dudley, and Kay Brinker as Weena. The musical score was conducted by Wilbur Hatch. Next week.
You are wandering in a vast white solitude, torn by the icy blast of Arctic wind, your strength ebbing and frozen death creeping up on you, and behind you a man with a gun from whom there is no escape.
Next week, we escape with another great story of high adventure by one of the world's best-known authors. Good night, then, until this same time next week, when once again we offer you Escape.
This is CBS, where 99 million people gather every week, the Columbia Broadcasting System.
Well, we've arrived at our last 30-minute program for this week, and it's going to be an episode of Gunsmoke. This one's a later episode from 1961. It's called Hard Virtue. So now let's go out to Matt Dillon, way out west.
Around Dodge City and in the territory on west, there's just one way to handle the killers and the spoilers. And that's with a U.S. Marshal and the smell of gun smoke. Gunsmoke, starring William Conrad. The story of the violence that moved west with young America. And the story of a man who moved with it.
I'm that man. Matt Dillon, United States Marshal. The first man they look for and the last they want to meet. It's a chancy job, and it makes a man watchful. And a little lonely.
When the Civil War began in 1861, there was no special services, and the chaplain's corps was in its infancy. The serviceman, sick or well, in the field or in the hospital, was left to his own devices during his free time. Then, the YMCA's United States Christian Commission was organized, with the approval and support of President Lincoln. Some 5,000 volunteers, men and women, gave spiritual, moral, and medical relief to soldiers and sailors of both sides, as well as prisoners of war. $6 million were raised to furnish supplies and do the work. They saved the lives of hundreds of fighting men and gave themselves untiringly. Today, along with the Civil War's 100th observance, the Armed Services Department of the YMCA is observing its centennial. Through the years, it has continued to serve our armed forces in this country and overseas. We salute the YMCA on the 100th anniversary of this work and for its services to young people of all races and creeds around the world.
I don't think I like Dodge too much, Andy. It kind of scares me.
Well, it ain't a bad town, Millie. Besides, we'll only be here long enough to get the old wagon sold.
Well, that's the livery stable, isn't it?
Yeah. Move there. Move. This shouldn't take very long. Hello.
Hello, stranger.
You run this stable?
I own it. Moss Grimmick.
Well, I'm Andy Cole. I had in mind to sell my wagon.
Oh?
I was told you might buy it. It's a good wagon. A little old, maybe.
You must be kind of broke.
We just moved into a shack down by the Arkansas, and we're looking to get a start somehow, but we need a little eating money till I find a job. I'll sell the wagon cheap, Mr. Grimmick.
Well, maybe I can help you out. Let's have a look.
What's that? Well, something spooked that team.
They're running wild.
Millie, are you hurt?
I'm all right.
Are you sure? Let me help you down.
I'm just scared. I can't. Shaken up so much. I should have jumped.
Who was that man driving the team?
Ed Fallon. He runs a freight line here.
Now, Andy, don't start trouble.
The woman's all right, isn't she?
Can't you handle them mules, mister?
Now, Andy.
You do that on purpose?
Of course I didn't do it on purpose. Some drunk come out of the saloon and spooked them. I feel terrible about this.
Well, you ought to feel terrible. You nearly killed her, you darn fool.
Andy!
You... You got a bad temper, ain't you?
You just bet I have.
Well, so have I when I get riled. I'll fix you good for this.
I'm waiting.
Andy, stop it.
Next time, you better be wearing a gun, mister.
Oh, now you're threatening me with a gun.
No, he isn't. And you're not going to start wearing one either, Andy.
Well, we'll see about
What's
that.
The trouble here?
Hello, Marshal. Chester, it's a good thing you've come.
Well, this man's threatened to come after me with a gun, Marshal.
He smashed into my wife with his wagon.
He didn't do it on purpose.
I wonder he didn't kill you.
He didn't kill me, though. I'm not even hurt. There's no cause for all this trouble.
He shouldn't be driving mules if he can't handle them.
What happened, Fallon?
Cowboys spooked my team and they run off. I couldn't help it.
Well, you sure ain't done their wagon much good.
Oh, we were going to sell it, too.
Oh. Well, I'll tell you what. I'll pay for it. What's it worth?
Never mind about that.
With $20 covered.
I ain't asking for money.
I'll take it. We need that money.
Why, sure. Sure. Here you are, man.
Thank you.
You're pretty broke, are you?
We're broke, all right.
Maybe I can help you out. I'll give your husband a job. Starting tomorrow.
Andy. You here?
Yeah. Yeah, I hear, and I don't like it. Why should he offer me a job? It don't make sense.
My gracious, Mr. Fallon's just trying to be nice to you.
Looks to me like you could use a job, son.
He's right, Andy.
All right. All right, I'll try your job, Mr. Fallon, but probably not for long.
You sure don't make it easy. Anyway, my office is right over there. I'll see you in the morning. And, good day, ma'am.
Good day, Mr. Fallon. Well, you see, it worked out fine, Andy. I sold the wagon and you got a job.
Yeah. But I don't like that man, Millie.
You got quite a temper, son. Why don't you just relax and take your wife on home?
Yeah. Sure. Come on.
Goodness me, sure is a hothead, ain't he?
Yeah, and a temper like that can cause a lot of trouble. Especially with a wife that pretty.
I had to ride out the country today and just stop by your place to see how things were going.
Well, that's very kind of you.
Well, you look like you thought maybe it was some bandit riding up.
Well, I didn't know.
No, I just wanted to be sure Andy wasn't home playing hooky while I was gone.
Andy wouldn't do a thing like that.
No, I was just joking. He's there on the job, all right, I'm sure of that. He's got 3 freight wagons to get loaded by noon.
Andy's a hard worker. You're going to be real pleased you hired him, Mr. Fallon.
Here now. You just call me Ed. We're friends, ain't we?
Why, yes, of course.
How about inviting me in for a cup of coffee?
Well, I'm not sure that would be proper.
Oh, there ain't nobody around. Ain't nobody to even know.
Well, I...
Millie... That job I give Andy, I'm paying him $1 a day more than it's worth.
I know.
Well, I ain't sure I could use a cup of coffee.
All right, Mr. Fallon. I'll make you a cup of coffee.
Now, that's right neighborly, you, Millie. I like that just fine.
Millie.
Oh, Andy. I didn't hear you ride up.
No.
What are you looking for?
There's been somebody here.
What?
Oh, maybe he was still around.
I don't know what you're talking about.
I've seen tracks outside, boot marks.
Well, they're yours.
No, they ain't mine. I don't wear Spanish heels. Now, who was here, Millie?
Nobody was here. What's got into you, anyway?
Now, don't you lie to me. You've never lied to me.
And I'm not lying now. Andy, you've been drinking.
I never drink, and you know it. Who was here today, Millie?
Nobody. Nobody was here. Now, I won't stand for this, Andy.
Well, I won't stand for it either.
Where are you going? Andy. Andy, put that gun back. Put it back, you hear?
You're covering up something, Millie. I'll find out who it is, and then I'll put the gun back. Not before.
There you are, Matt.
Thanks, Kitty.
You know, that's better beer than we've been getting lately.
Yeah, I think it is.
Maybe I ought to start charging more for it.
On second thought, kind of flat, isn't it?
You're a hard man, Matthew. Say, how's Andy Cole getting along in his job with Fallon?
I don't know, Kitty. I saw Andy today. He was wearing a gun.
Well, that doesn't exactly make him stand out around here, does it?
Yeah, that's the first time I've seen him wear one since he arrived in town.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I asked him about it. He told me some man was visiting his wife yesterday. She wouldn't tell him who it was. I tried to talk to him, but it didn't do any good.
Never does in a case like that.
Evening, Mac. Kitty?
Hello, Doc.
Sit down, Doc.
Oh.
How about a beer?
Oh, now I'd like that.
Sam, bring Doc a beer, will you?
Yes, Miss Kitty. You two look mighty glum. Is something wrong?
We were just talking about Andy Cole.
Andy Cole? I met his wife today. Nice girl.
Oh? Where'd you meet her? Here in town?
No, I was driving by their shack by the river there, so I stopped and said hello.
So you're the one?
What?
Nothing.
Well, what were you saying about Andy?
Well, Matt's worried about him.
Andy's wearing a gun today for the first time.
Well, what for?
He suspects somebody's been visiting his wife.
Maybe he's after me, then.
This isn't a joke, Doc.
Well, no, I guess it is.
And he's a good boy, but he's awful hot-headed.
You know, this morning I made Millie Coe a promise. But I think maybe I should break it.
What are you talking about?
She gave me a note to deliver. Asked me not to tell anyone about it. It was for Ed Fallon.
Fallon?
Did you give it to him?
Yeah. Just now when it came in. He's standing right down there at the end of the bar.
Oh, yeah. You know what was in the note?
No, she didn't say. Just that it had something to do with business.
That's what she told you, huh?
Yeah. Why, you think it was something more?
I don't know, Doc. But if Millie wrote a note to Fallon, it could be he's the one. Yeah, I'll be back. Fallon?
Yeah. Hello, Marshal. What's on your mind?
I want to talk to you about Millie Cole.
What?
Have you been seeing her?
What business of yours would I do, Marshal?
I'm trying to stop a killing, Fallon. I thought you might want to help.
I believe in law and order. You know that.
Then keep away from Millie Cole.
Now, look, Marshal.
Andy's wearing a gun, Fallon. You saw him. If you have been seeing his wife and he finds out, he'll kill you.
You seem to know a lot about this, Marshal.
Enough to know that you got a note from her today.
That note had to do with business.
Whatever it was, I'm just warning you. Stay away from her.
Well, what'd you find out, Matt?
I can't pin him down.
You tell him about the note?
Mm-hmm.
Well, you'd never own up to it anyway.
Well, I gotta make sure before Andy finds out.
Why are you gonna do that?
Go out tomorrow and talk to Millie Cole. Face her with it. Hope she tells the truth.
to jump double Dutch today. It's fun.
What, Susan, is double Dutch?
That's jumping with two ropes at a time. Anyone knows that.
Uh-huh. Thank you. Susan is one of the lucky ones, one of the healthy, normal children we all give thanks for. She can run and skate and even jump double Dutch. But there are over 250,000 other children in the United States who can't. They have cerebral palsy. They will never take part in active sports, maybe not even walk, but they can be helped. Through therapy and through special training, many cerebral palsied learn to live satisfactory and useful lives. There are 344 local affiliates of United Cerebral Palsy who support the hundreds of programs in hospitals, clinics, and special schools that are so needed. United Cerebral Palsy asks you to help. Contribute to the 53-minute march on cerebral palsy. Do it today.
More coffee?
No, thanks, Millie.
Marshal, I don't know what makes you think Mr. Fallon has been visiting me.
Andy's wearing a gun, Millie, and he means to use it.
I know.
Was it Fallon?
Nobody's been out here except you and Doc Adams.
Andy doesn't believe that.
Do you?
No.
Marshal, it's true. What's the matter with you men? Would you take a woman's word for anything? Andy.
Oh. Marshal Dillon. You're about the last man I would have suspected, Marshal.
Andy, wait.
You stay out of this, Millie. You just keep your hands where they are, Marshal.
You're making a mistake, Andy.
You've already made yours, and it was a bad one, a real bad one.
Now, you listen to me.
I'll kill you, Marshal. I swear I will.
Andy, it wasn't the Marshal.
No.
Andy, I think it was Fallon.
Fallon?
I came out here to prove it if I could.
How are you going to do that?
By facing Millie with it. She's a poor liar, Andy.
Was it Fallon, Millie?
There wasn't anybody out here, Andy.
You're lying. It was Fallon. Who else would it be? Sure, the whole thing figures out easy.
Now, wait a minute, Andy.
I know you're trying to stop a shooting, Marshal, but it won't do no good. I'll kill Fallon on sight.
Not while I'm around, you won't. You're going to go back to Dodge with me, Andy, and we'll have this out there and without gunplay. Now, let's go. Don't worry, Millie. It's going to be all right.
Andy. 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 You.
It's me, all right. You surprised?
They were both here. Andy and the Marshal.
Yeah, I seen them. I've been waiting for them to leave.
How long you been here?
Long enough to see Andy ride up.
He knows it was you. He knows you've been visiting me. The Marshal told him.
The Marshal told him. What kind of a lie is that?
It's true.
You told him, Millie. Nobody else could have. You got me in a fine mess now, haven't you?
I wish I had told him. I wish I had.
You're no better than the rest of them. Prettier, that's all.
You get out of here.
Not quite yet. First, I'm going to teach you a lesson. I'm going to teach you to keep your mouth shut.
Get out of here.
Like I said, not quite yet.
I ain't saw Fallon around town all day, Mr. Dillon.
He may be here at his office.
He better be. Well, Andy, where you been? I looked everywhere for you.
Where's Fallon, Jenkins?
I don't know.
Take a look out back, Chester.
Yes, sir.
Maybe you wouldn't mind telling me what's going on here, Marshal.
Like Andy said, we're looking for Fallon.
Well, Fallon's going to be looking for him. He finds out Andy's been loafing on the job.
Fallon's paying Andy too much money as it is.
Not for long, he ain't.
You're getting a dollar a day more than you're worth, Andy.
Whose idea was that, Jenkins, to pay him that money?
It wasn't mine. I'm only the clerk here. Besides, I don't have no reason for it, do I?
But Fallon does, huh?
Ain't nobody back there, Mr. Dillon.
All right, where is he, Jenkins?
You sure you want me to tell you, Marshal?
Did he go out to Andy's place?
He was looking kind of worried after talking to you last night.
Then he is out there.
He sure is, and you're looking mighty stupid, son. Running all over the country while Fallon's out there courting your wife, having himself a fine time.
Why, you...
Come on, Andy, don't waste your time. Let's go.
No horse. He sure must come afoot.
I just got a feeling that there's something wrong.
Andy.
Millie, what happened to you?
Andy.
Well, what happened? Are you hurt?
I'm all right.
Fallon. Where's Fallon? He's here. I know it. Now, where is he, Millie?
In there. In the house.
Fallon.
He got shot. Who did it, Fallon? Who shot you?
Millie?
Yeah.
I tried to beat her. She shot me. I ain't doing so good.
Why didn't you tell me that first day?
I didn't want any trouble, Andy. But I was wrong, too. I'm not telling you.
Well, the trouble's all over now.
I was going to the river to wash when I heard you ride up.
Come on. I'll go with you.
This is Dennis James to make a point about reliable, effective Kellogg's All Bran. Repeat after me, please. What do you want when you need bran?
What do you want when you need bran?
Reliability.
Reliability.
Now, what do you get in Kellogg's All Bran?
What do you get in Kellogg's All Bran? Reliability.
Right. There's nothing like the reliable Kellogg way to get the effectiveness you want from bran. Kellogg's All Bran is the real Battle Creek formula with more of the vital bran bulk to help you keep regular. Low in calories and mighty appetizing. That's Kellogg's All Bran. And take advantage of the special rosebush offer now on the package. Famous queen of the garden rosebushes, 6 formerly patented varieties, every one a beauty, at just a fraction of their usual cost. Yours for only 50 cents a bush when you include a box top from reliable, effective Kellogg's All Bran.
Gunsmoke. Produced and directed in Hollywood by Norman McDonald, stars William Conrad as Matt Dillon, U.S. Marshal. The story was specially written for Gunsmoke by John Meston and adapted for radio by Mr. McDonald. Featured in the cast were Gene Bates, Vic Perrin, John Daner, and Harry Bartell. Harley Bear is Chester, Howard McNear is Doc, and Georgia Ellis is Kitty. This is George Walsh inviting you to join us again next week when CBS Radio presents another story on Gunsmoke. Have a Happy Habit, Monday through Friday, with Bing Crosby and Rosemary Clooney on the CBS Radio Network.
Well, all podcasts must come to an end, and this one just has. But we'll be back next week with more, so join us then. Till then, this is Jim Dolan, thanking you for